Well, good morning. I'm Jan Crable. I'm an emeritus professor from the College of Veterinary Medicine at Michigan State University, and it is my pleasure this morning to visit with Dr. Peter Prescott. As many of you know, Dr. Prescott served as the executive director of the Michigan Veterinary Medical Association for many years, and our purpose this morning is to provide some background, some history of the Michigan Veterinary Medical Association, and it's indeed a pleasure to start with Dr. Prescott, who served in this capacity as the executive director for a number of years. So, Dr. Prescott, as you look back on your career in veterinary medicine, you spent a fair amount of time with the MVMA. How and when did you come to be the executive director of MVMA, and what were some of the things involved in your acquiring this position?
Oh, thanks for the introduction, Jan. I was in private practice for over 25 years, and had a background in small animal medicine, and got very interested in organized veterinary medicine over the years, especially with continuing education. And along about 1970, I think it was, the president of the MVMA, Ken McCursey, called me and asked me if I'd take over the CE committee for the MVMA, which was primarily the education at our annual meeting. And from there, I went through various positions with the MVMA, committee chairs, board of directors, these types of things. And eventually, I started through the chairs. And Harold Knirk was our executive director at that time. And I thought about it and decided that probably I'd never have another chance to be the executive director. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself just a little bit. I agreed to go through the chairs under one condition, and that is that Harold Knirk stay on as executive director through my tenure, because I was very fond of Harold, and he was doing a good job with the MVMA. And he said he would, and we started through the chairs. And when I was, vice president, there were 5 years, I think, at that time you were involved, first and second vice president, president-elect president, and then immediate past president. I think it was when I was vice president. Harold decided he was going to retire. Now, that's the only time in Harold's life I think he lied, when he said he would not retire when I was. But anyways, not only did he retire, but he talked me into running for the position. And I gave some thought to it and said, there'll never be another time that I might be able to do this. And I enjoyed association work. And fortunately, I had a veterinarian that was with my partner and I in practice, who was willing to buy my part of the practice. And so I submitted my name and got selected. And that was in 1984 I started. And I stayed on as executive director until 2004, 20 years even.
Now, Pete, you use the term going through the chairs. Can you explain exactly what that means?
Well, we have five positions going through the chairs, as I said, starting with vice presidents, two of them, and president-elect, president, and immediate past president. And generally, when you started through the chairs, you went the whole way. Now, if you didn't do a good job, you could get voted out of that position going through. But I don't recall ever anybody getting voted out once they got started going through the chairs. So you were kind of making a commitment for 5 years when you agreed to do that.
So these were positions kind of on the executive board as you moved up to ultimately becoming the president of the MVMA.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, when you took the position as executive director, what did you feel was the primary purpose of the MVMA as an association?
Well, it was an association of veterinarians. And so I felt the MVMA's job was helping veterinarians. We didn't have a lot of contact with the public, like some organizations might. Most of our work was with the veterinarians, and then the veterinarians went out and did their thing in the public. But having come from private practice, I had a pretty good idea of how practitioners, which were the makeup of most of our membership, how they thought about issues. And having been on a number of different committee chairs and so forth, I had a pretty good idea how the association ran. But I had never had any real experience or training in being an association executive. So I kind of categorized the objectives of the MVMA into four categories. One was education. One was legislation. One was public education or public relations, whatever you want to call it, and services.
Now, you mentioned that you came from private practice. Would you share a little bit with us whether that was a benefit? Did that assist in your role as executive director, or was that a disadvantage?
Well, mostly it was an advantage. Mm-hmm. Because I knew how practitioners thought, and these were the people that we were working with, and these were the people that were trying to help. I kind of had an old saying that veterinary medicine, it was pretty easy to make a good living on it, and it was pretty easy to do a good job. The hard part was doing them both at the same time, mm-hmm. and kind of that's where I was going with this job there, is to mm-hmm. do the best I could to help the practitioners out there do a better job and make a good living.
So what were some of the challenges, issues that MVMA faced, how did you work with the executive board and the board of directors to meet those challenges?
Well, probably the... if I thought about things that were a challenge, that the toughest issue we have faced is that of mandatory continuing education for veterinarians. About the late 1970s, 1978, I think it was, they passed the public health code. And veterinarians are included in the public health code along with all the other health professions, doctors, dentists, and so forth. And the major associations like physicians and dentists, optometrists, and so forth, they had in their part of the law a requirement for continuing education to be relicensed. But they left veterinary medicine out. And this was kind of a slap in the face, I guess you'd say, for our profession. Michigan had, as a veterinary association, Michigan was, I think we consider ourselves one of the pioneers on veterinary continuing education. In the 60s, probably, educational programs consisted of having a salesman come in for your evening meetings and so forth and talk about their latest drug. Or there were really only two good CE sessions in Michigan at that time. One was the postgraduate conference that MSU put on, and the other was the annual meeting of the MVMA. The Southeastern Michigan Association, where I was a member before I even got onto into the MVMA, started up and was one of the first associations to have a significant continuing education program. And one of the philosophies that our committee had back then was that continuing education should come out of your work time and not your family time. In other words, rather than going to meetings on Sunday and evenings and stuff, we started putting on our seminars during the week on Wednesdays all day, you know, and people had to shut down their practices if they're alone to come in and attend it. But it worked out very well. It was very well approved of by our membership. And to give you an example, Charlie Reed, I don't know if you knew Charlie or not, you probably
yes,
did.
Sure.
Charlie was very interested in CE from MVMA. He was a dean at the time, and he and I were pretty good friends, and both of us were very interested in continuing education. And there was a national meeting, I can't remember the exact year or where it was, but there was a national meeting of association, probably AVMA put it on, to discuss continuing education and where we're going with it with our profession. And Charlie and I went to this meeting. And when the meeting started, the first thing they did, they went around the room and they asked each state what was their biggest concern on continuing education. And you got the usual, you know, how do you get people to attend? Where do you get your speakers and all this type of thing? And when they got to Michigan, Charlie and I, our answer was, and we didn't mean it to be derogatory or anything, but our biggest problem is finding a room big enough to get all the people in that wanted CE. And I say it was not a joke. That was, we just had people pounding on the doors to get into these things. And as a result, our CE committee kind of developed the thought that if we make continuing education mandatory, then we really wouldn't know whether these people are coming in because they like the program and are learning something or because they have to. So when this public health code was passed and continuing education was the going thing there, we were a little skeptical about getting involved in that anyway. But the alternatives, one of the alternatives was reexamination. And, of course, nobody wanted that. So our committee got together with the Board of Veterinary Medicine, the veterinarians and the Board of Veterinary Medicine, and we decided that really a good way to handle the competency issue for veterinary practices is to have a practice accreditation program. This is where your practice would be evaluated. There'll be certain requirements these practices have. It wasn't a real detailed program like the animal hospital program, but got the basics in there of what we think was kind of the minimum standards everybody should have to practice veterinary medicine. And it became quite popular. We eventually got up to about 100 practices involved. The Board of Veterinary Medicine, the veterinarians on there, were watching us very closely and encouraging us, because what they wanted to do was if we could get this program going and successful, we'd get the state to approve it as our method of guarantee of competency assessment for our profession. Well, the state shot it down. They didn't want any part of it. So we were back to really the only alternative was mandatory continuing education. And we came up with a number of programs over the years that were very easy for the state to manage, very inexpensive, and the state was very excited with them, and they'd put them away someplace and forget about them. And I think about the time I retired, the state said, okay, we'll set up our own program. We'll figure out a program. And they got a program drafted. I've read parts of it over the years and was a little bit more involved than most of the continuing education programs, but it was okay. And we're still waiting. And I don't know how long they've been sitting on that. So I kind of have got the idea that I may never see mandatory continuing education for veterinarians. But that was about 30 years mm-hmm. we've been trying to get this thing done, and we haven't got it done. So I guess you'd have to say that was our biggest challenge, and we've failed so far.
Well, I don't know that you've failed. I think that your reputation, Pete, is one of very positive support for veterinarians and certainly an active proponent of continuing education. Now, if I look back in my role with the College of Veterinary Medicine at MSU, we had a very close association with MVMA. And I'd like you to share with us a little bit of how the Veterinary College and MVMA came together over the issue of continuing education and particularly annual meetings providing that kind of instruction and experience for veterinarians. We now have a Michigan Veterinary Conference every January that is a very good meeting. And I think we owe that in large measure to your efforts and interacting with the college to make it happen. So can you give us a little background on that?
Yeah, we can go back on kind of the growth of continuing education, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But when I first started in practice, which was in the late 50s and then in the early 60s, the only really significant continuing education, as I mentioned before, was the postgraduate conference put on by the university in January and the summer conference put on by the MVMA. And a number of times we had tried to figure out a way that maybe we should try to combine these two meetings to be more competitive with other conferences around the country. Community education was growing. It was lots of attendance was very well attended, and our meetings, the MVMA's annual meeting, was generally in the fall, and MVMA's conference was in January. One year, we ended up with both meetings scheduled for the Lansing area about a month apart. And one of the handicaps we'd had to put on a joint meeting was a place to put it on, because there really wasn't any place, except now, at that time, the Lansing Center opened up. So now we had a place we could put on a big meeting, and we were in a situation where it was getting ridiculous, one meeting on top of the other. And on our CE committee, we had a faculty member, Don Sawyer, who was very interested in combining these two meetings. And he talked MSU into agreeing to combine these with MVMA. So MVMA canceled their fall meeting that year, and we just built it into to what is now called the Michigan Veterinary Conference. And we wanted to have it in the Lansing area because of all the alumni activities. And the Lansing Center allowed us to do that. On the first conference that we had, I can remember sitting and talking to Don Sawyer during the meeting, and we looked out the window, and this is the middle of January. The sun was shining. It was about 50 degrees. And Don and I said, well, the god of continuing education has apparently approved of our move, because the meeting was very successful. We had more people attend that meeting than we had the other two put together. And this was the Michigan Veterinary Conference was kind of almost a separate entity. MSU doing half the work, sharing the profits or loss on it, and there was always, we always came out in the black on it. But we worked it out very well, and to this day, it's going strong.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember those meetings in the 60s and the 70s, and how they attracted alumni and former students from the College of Veterinary Medicine at MSU, and the really great reunions that we had at the meetings, along with some wonderful continuing education. So I think it's important to remember that Dean Reed, yourself, and Don Sawyer were involved in bringing that together, and it is very healthy, going strong, and improves every year. Let's talk a little more about some of the leadership in the Michigan Veterinary Medical Association and some of the veterinarians from the past that were special contributors and helped the the association become as strong as it is today?
Well, I think number one on my list would have to be my predecessor, Harold Kinnerk. Harold was came out of private practice. He had a practice down in the southern part of the state for a number of years. And when he decided he'd had enough of practice and retired, he came up here to the university and helped get the technician program started. I think he was the first director of the technician program and got that going. And when he had that issue solved, MVMA had moved from its former location in, I think it was Kalamazoo. MVMA had moved into quarters here in the Lansing area. They wanted to be near the university and the Department of Agriculture, and MVMA all being in the same vicinity had a lot of advantages on dealing with issues. And to get the association going, they hired Harold Kinnerk, and he came in and did a great job with the association. And so when I took over, the association was in good shape, so I didn't have any problems of having to do anything to get it going well. Another veterinarian that I think I'd have to put up as one of the leaders of our profession was Arnie Henschel. Arnie not only was big with MVMA, he was also big with AVMA and spent a lot of years in AVMA. But what I remember most about Arnie was Arnie kind of liked to pick on me a little bit, and he'd harass me. But and anytime anything I'd write or do or something, I'm liable to get a call from Arnie and criticizing me and shaking me up on the issues, whatever they were. But it got to be, if Arnie didn't call me, I was worried, because nobody had overseen what I was doing. And I knew if Arnie called me and I got by Arnie, that I was going to be okay.
He was watching.
Yeah, and another thing that I didn't mention, that going through the chairs, when Harold retired, I was president-elect. And so the issue became, what do we do for a president if Pete's the executive director? Well, the board decided nothing wrong with having two jobs. And so one year I was executive director and president. And the first meeting we had, and Arnie came to this meeting, he had two hats. One said executive director and the other said president. And he says, Pete, when you're talking to me, put on the right hat so I know how to respond.
That's great. I had not heard that. Now, Dr. Henschel served as treasurer for a number of years, too,
yes.
Did he not?
Yes, he did. And he was really, next to Harold Kinnerk, the guiding light for our association.
He also served on the executive board of the American Veterinary Medical Association, and I believe the last year he was the chairman of that group.
Yeah,
so
he
had both state and national experience in organized veterinary medicine. So who are some of the other folks that were big contributors to leadership in MVMA?
You know, I hate to start naming names because I'll leave somebody out. But really, all the presidents we had contributed.
Mm-hmm.
I think committees were really the backbone of our association, and all the people that chaired committees helped. But if I was going to pick out a couple more names, one would have to be Mary Beth Leininger.
Mm-hmm.
She was the first woman president of the MVMA.
Mm-hmm.
And she was also the first female president of the AVMA. And her leadership as a woman really helped get the gender change going, where you couldn't see really nothing happened any different. When Mary Beth was president, she worked just like the the males.
She had a practice in the Detroit area.
Yep.
She and her husband
she was practiced down in Plymouth,
together.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to note, she received her DVM at Purdue University, but she was an ardent supporter of Spartans and certainly of the Michigan Veterinary Medical Association. So we really appreciate her contributions.
Another name that is history with MVMA is Ken McCursey. He died at a much too young age, but our service award is now called the McCursey Service Award in honor of him, because he was just one of these people that worked his tail off for the association. And I think that's really what makes somebody valuable to the association, when they're really got the association as their plan. And most all our presidents did work hard for the association. The generation that's still going on now, Steve Steep, I'd have to put his name in there too. Now, Steve was, I think, the first veterinarian that understood a computer. And in that age, when I started out, we didn't have computers in the association. And so when we started getting computerized, probably the most illiterate person on computers was me. But Steve was always around, and he just helped the association tremendously with their audiovisual programs and computers, and he still is. And another name that I think I mentioned is Judy Violante, and she was one of our first female presidents. But she did a lot of contributing as far as getting students programs going and getting students involved with MVMA, which beforehand the student programs never amounted to a whole lot, but that was her probably her primary objective there. But again, you know, I can't complain about any of our presidents not being willing to work.
I want to go back to a couple of things. You mentioned Dr. Steve Steep, and you mentioned his expertise in instructional technology and in computer technology. Not many people probably know that Steve serves as a statistician, or did serve as a statistician, for the Detroit Lions.
Yeah.
And so he would go to the games each Sunday, and he'd have a lot of stats that were used by the team, by the coaches, and so on. And I always enjoyed visiting with him about that. Judy Violante is a student I remember very well. She was a very good friend, and I remember her in class. She would usually sit on the front row, and on her desk she would take out a little bag of M&Ms, and she would lay that on the desk and have her notes next to that. And so she'd proceed to listen very attentively, take notes, and periodically she'd eat one of those M&Ms. And so I remember asking her why she did that. I said, "Don't you have time for lunch and breakfast and those kind of things?" She said, "Oh, no." She says, "I have to do that to keep from going to sleep." She said, "Some of the lectures are not all that exciting, so that's my crutch to stay awake and take good notes." But she was a bright student, a wonderful person. And I believe, Pete, she was the second representative on our admissions committee to the College of Veterinary Medicine as we reviewed applications. Now, the first member on that committee from the MVMA, I believe, was yourself.
That's correct, yes.
And you served for several years, did a terrific job, and then Judy followed you and also did a great job and really, as you say, loved the students and was terrific about it. Pete, as you look back over your career in veterinary practice, and then your role as the executive director of MVMA, can you share with us your perspective of how veterinary practice itself has changed over the last 20, 30 years? Companion animal practice, food animal practice, and so on. What things do you look back on and remember most vividly about how our profession has changed?
Probably the biggest change in our profession has been the gender change, going from almost 100% male profession to close to 100% female profession now, or at least well up there. And that started about the time I was coming in as an executive director. And I was a typical chauvinist man, as most of us were, and we made some mistakes. And about the first piece of mail I got as the executive director was a scathing letter from two of our female veterinarians. And I had said something at a committee meeting or something that was not meant to be nasty or anything, but was definitely a sexist remark, like we had some cute people in our committee or some dumb thing that only a male would say at that point in our life. But anyway, I got these two people to come in. One of them was Judy Violante. And I talked to him, and I said, I'm appointing you as a committee of two to watch me. And you catch these things before I get in trouble with them. And you shape me up. Don't write me a nasty letter. Just call me up and tell me, Pete, mm-hmm. you got to do something different. Mm-hmm. And that was a big difference in the profession of trying to – there's still some things that our older – mostly our older veterinarians have not really adjusted to the change. Right. But another – something that really helped that was Mary Beth Leininger. She was president, I think, just two or three years after I started on. And with her as president, there wasn't a whole lot of argument that women couldn't do the job. Mm-hmm. Mary Beth was somebody that she expected me to put her on a pedestal, to open the doors for her, and all the things that gentlemen do for ladies, where some of the women are getting involved were self-conscious about that and thought it was kind of improper for males to treat them like that. But Mary Beth was one, she's going to be treated well, but she's going to run the association. And she did a good job and kept me on my toes all the time. One of the biggest improvements our profession has made is the development of specialty practices as a private enterprise. I thought for a number of years we're developing specialists at the universities, but the only place they're working are universities, and that really doesn't make for a strong profession. But once the specialty practices started going public, they have certainly put our practice level at a higher standard. Thinking of other changes that we've gone through in small animal practice, when I came on board, most of the practices were one, two-person practices. You can say back then one or two man practices because there weren't any women involved. But over the years, we went through the change of getting group practices and then corporate practices. And that was a worry for a lot of our practitioners that had small practice, a little bit like the Walmart issue now, where Walmart comes in and the little guys kind of get driven out. And that was a worry, and rightly so, for our members. It was also a little bit of a worry for MVMA because, especially the corporations, they provided a lot of services to their veterinarians that normally the MVMA would provide, for instance, things like insurance programs and continuing education mm-hmm. things and so forth. And another problem that concerned us on group practices is that with four or five veterinarians in a practice, maybe only one or two of them would decide to belong because they'd get all the benefits, the mailings and so forth. And what we did especially on our CE programs, there was a significant discount if you were a member, trying to get as many people in the practice involved as we could. We tried various different things, like group practices could get a discount on all their members, but it never changed our number of getting in. Mm-hmm. Food animal practitioner, I think the biggest change I noticed in them, they kind of went from from just a working veterinarian to part of the management team of the farms. And now with a lot of the big farms hiring their own veterinarians and having two or three veterinarians on their staff full time is not an unusual thing. It certainly brought the food animal profession up to a higher level.
Mm-hmm. So most of these changes really raise the level of practice, the standards of practice, and the quality of care that veterinarians provided, not only for companion animals, but food animals and others as well.
Right, yeah. I think the public changed veterinary medicine more than veterinary medicine changed the public, because mm-hmm. people wanted this high-tech stuff. And I think a lot of times veterinarians were at fault. They didn't believe, well, nobody will spend that to have a mm-hmm. cancer treatment on my dog. Mm-hmm. But we found out that, especially with the human-animal bond, what it was, the cost was not necessarily the limiting factor. Our limiting factor was our ability. Mm-hmm. But as those specialists went out into private practice, we have the ability now to do things that just amaze me. Mm-hmm. That if you'd asked me when I was in practice, no, we'd never have anything that cost that much. Mm-hmm. But it's the profession has really grown up on that. One of the areas that is a little concern for veterinarians is the alternate therapies, alternate chiropractic mm-hmm. use and a number of those. What's the one where the odors? What do they call that?
The aromatherapy.
Yeah, aromatherapy mm-hmm. and things. We weren't taught about those things, mm-hmm. and it has kind of been interesting to watch it yeah. develop. And for instance, chiropractic, I had a number of my members tell me that they used a chiropractor. They didn't know why it worked, but if they had mm-hmm. a horse that was lame and they couldn't get it straightened out, and the chiropractor came in, it cured the lameness. But it still was kind of a mystery, I think, mm-hmm. Our professions on some of these alternate therapies.
The concerns then relate to the scientific basis for whatever therapy is used, whatever alternative is used to our traditional science-based veterinary medical practice.
If we couldn't see it in anatomy class, then it didn't count.
Okay. Pete, you talked a little earlier about moving from Battle Creek to the Lansing area with the offices for MVMA, and it certainly evolved and gone beyond that. Tell us a little bit about the places that the office was stationed, and then how it moved now to a building that the association owns and so on.
When I came on board, Harold Knirk had a office in the basement of the Manly Miles building, and I think it was about 400 square feet or something. When I got involved there, in about 5 years, we had outgrown that, and I moved up to the top floor of the Manly Miles building where we were renting. And after about 5 years there, we had outgrown that, so we moved to a rented facility on Science Parkway.
In Okemos.
In Okemos, yes, okay. In Okemos. And after about another 5 years, we had outgrown that. And the board finally decided it's time for us to get our own place. And there was a lot of building going on in Okemos, and we found a location as a section of a building that was right near the expressway. It was in the building stages, so we could go in and design it the way we wanted to. And my number one helper, Sherry, and I figured out how we wanted the layout of the meeting and of the facility. And that still remains today as our home. We made it big enough that we haven't had a move yet. But that was because Jeff Dizik told me to be sure to put a basement in for junk. So we have a basement full of stuff, but the staff is now fully filling up the main part of the building.
Well, and it's a very nice building, not far from the corner of Okemos Road and Jolly Road, and as you say, near an expressway. But I remember that time, and Dr. Dizik and Sherry Fandel were key players in helping with that. And it certainly has been a very, not only attractive, but very useful facilities. I assume committee meetings are held there and other sorts of planning activities for the association?
Yeah, and we let other organizations use it, like okay. Maybe the Department of Agriculture, yep. If they needed mm-hmm. a place for a little meeting or something like this. We didn't. The meeting room wasn't that big. We could get maybe 15 or 20 people max into that. Mm-hmm. But we encouraged other related organizations to use it if they needed it. We didn't charge for it, but we're mm-hmm. just trying to blend in with the other organizations that mm-hmm. were involved in the same issues we were.
Pete, as an executive director of the MVMA, you interacted, I believe, with executive directors of other professional associations. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and were there benefits in that and so on?
Well, if it hadn't been for other associations, I probably wouldn't have lasted because I didn't come in as a polished executive director. I was a practicing veterinarian and probably didn't even know who the governor was at that time. But I got lucky and met the executive director of the Optometric Association, Bill Dansby, shortly after I got here. And I figured out in a hurry that of all the health professions, optometric medicine probably closely related to our profession because it was mostly small businesses with one or two doctors in it, and their incomes were more in the range that veterinarians had. And Bill then invited me to join Capital Club, which was a Lansing area group of association executives. And most of the people in Capital Club were lobbyists, and that was their primary job, which meant that our topics a lot of times had to do with state legislation and so forth, which was my weakness. And so I got my education on the legal aspects and the lobbying aspects of how associations were run and found it very helpful. In addition to the fact that one of the pluses of that was a lot of the resorts around the state were trying to get programs from members of the Capital Club. So Capital Club, about three or four times a year, got invited to Boyne Mountain or Grand Hotel or these places for a little experience on their facilities. And in all honesty, all the meetings that we put on in summer conferences, not our annual meeting, but the summer conference that we have now, they came about because I visited that, and they talked me into coming. So, one of the things that this being involved with a number of other associations was about the second or third year I was here. We have nine states. You know what nine? You've mm-hmm. been to nine states. That's
yes. It's a coalition of nine states in the upper Midwest that meet once a year. To look at issues that are affecting veterinarians in their respective states and how they might work together to address some of those issues.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to try something different if I could. You always want something that maybe nobody's heard before. Mm-hmm. But what I do is I set up a session of kind of round tables, and we maybe had four or five of them. And of the nine states people, they were spread out, and each had a different topic that they needed to discuss related to running association. But I invited in a number of my executive directors from other associations, and I had somebody from a different association at every table to kind of say, well, this is the way we do it in human medicine or optometric medicine or something. Here's how we set up these things. And it was it worked out pretty well that you, mm-hmm. you got something in from someplace else. But again, that was an advantage of knowing some executives around the city.
Well, that's very creative programming. I might share with you that I just returned from that meeting, which the state of Indiana, the Indiana Veterinary Medical Association, hosted a couple of weeks ago. And it has grown. It is no longer called Ninth States. It's called the Heartland Veterinary Association, and it now involves 13 states, with each of those respective states or some of the smaller states pairing up and hosting that state on an alternate year basis. So it's very good, and I'm sure you contributed to the strength of that organization.
That was a good organization to help you mm-hmm. develop when you were yeah. Especially an early executive.
Right, particularly helpful for those new members on the executive board who are moving up through the chairs to become presidents of their respective associations.
Yeah, knowing the other state executives in the area, you know, when I had a question on how something should be done, I could poll them very easily mm-hmm. and usually get some good ideas of what would work and wouldn't work on that. So that interacting with other associations was really important.
Yeah. Pete, sometimes executive directors and their boards may not see situations in the same light, and there might be a little tension between the executive director and the board. Did that ever occur? And if it did, how did you handle it?
Now, I can't recall any issue that was really a concern. Now, mm-hmm. we had disagreements and stuff on things, but mm-hmm. nothing that really caused a lot mm-hmm. of a problem. But in fact, about the only time that I would get upset with the board or a committee was if I thought we were getting involved in an antitrust issue. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they called me Paranoid Pete because I was very concerned of being sure our association didn't get into an antitrust issue, which some other states had had that happen mm-hmm. in other associations. Mm-hmm. And if it came down to push and shove, I said, if we decide to do this, I'm leaving because I don't want to spend that much time in court. Mm-hmm. And I had a big advantage on a lot of these issues because I did come from private practice. And most of the board members were private practitioners. So our thoughts and ideas were pretty much along the same line. And so we didn't have a lot of conflicts mm-hmm. on issues.
Pete, MVMA and the College of Veterinary Medicine have a long history of working well together. Why did that occur? And what were some of the things that were accomplished in the joint efforts between the college and the State Veterinary Association?
When you think about it, the College of Veterinary Medicine and the MVMA have the same objective, and that is making good veterinarians. So we weren't, conflicting with our end results. We were together on it. And I think both organizations were very conscious of keeping each other involved. As you mentioned before, the admissions committee, having mm-hmm. having somebody from MVMA on the admission committee. And we had a number of faculty members that were president of the organization. In fact, mm-hmm. Jim Lloyd just went off as president, one of the deans. And we tried to have faculty members on appropriate committees. So we're always keeping in touch with each other. But obviously, we can work together because working that Michigan Veterinary Conference, I think we're still the only state that has a fully separate entity of a meeting between their state association and the college. Mm-hmm.
There were some challenges over the years that livestock producers, people in the state of Michigan, faced. One of those that I recall was referred to as the PBB crisis. Can you tell me a little bit about that and how the college and the MVMA might have approached dealing with that?
PBB, I think, was before my time on the as executive director. I might have been going, I can't remember the exact years of that.
I think that was late 70s, early 80s, that could have been just a little before.
Before I got on board, so I didn't have really anything to do with that. Probably the closest thing to that since I came on board was the TB problem.
Yeah, right, good.
And our Food Animal Committee worked very closely with the Department of Agriculture trying to develop a testing program and so forth to solve this issue. I can't think of any other. The parvovirus epidemic that occurred in a small animal was a little before my time. That's when parvo first showed its ugly head, and there weren't any vaccines available and so forth. That was a big issue, but I was involved directly into that as a practitioner. Most of the time, the responsibility of our office was keeping our members appraised of what's going on with any of these issues.
But okay, so it was communications, basically a network that worked with the College of Veterinary Medicine to inform veterinarians of some of the concerns related to those issues.
Yeah, as far as I was concerned, the most important responsibility of MVMA was education. Mm-hmm. Now, that means continuing education, technology, and so forth, as well as all the other issues that go on in veterinary medicine. We had a monthly newsletter, and most of that's now getting computerized now, where you get a monthly or weekly email on all that stuff. But keeping the members up to date on what's going on and what's going on in technology was the number one thing the association did. Our legislative efforts at that time were one of the things that I had to do was I checked the bills as they came out of the legislature, because veterinarians being in the same law as the other health professions, there was always something going on where they forgot that one of the patients has four legs instead of two. And something silly would come out once in a while, like saying is now a law that before you give a controlled substance, you have to ask the patient such and such. and things like that were just kind of, most of them, there was no intent to involve the veterinarians. And there would be, on occasion, an issue that we needed to solve. One was one of the early issues was that of the abandoned animal law required that if a veterinarian had an animal abandoned in their practice, they had to wait 25 days before they could get rid of that animal. And if you had a 100-pound Rottweiler that was mean, having him around for 25 days was a long time. We got that changed to 10 days. We got a Good Samaritan bill passed where veterinarians were, if they got trying to help out in an accident or something, they did not have responsibility except for gross negligence. But there were very few issues that we had to deal with. Now, I still sit in on the legislative committee meeting, and most of the issues now have to do with animal welfare. Mm-hmm. With the animal rights people and so forth, they just keep coming up with legislative things that indirectly may affect the veterinarian. Veterinarians are in a tough spot on that because animal owners, especially in food animals and so forth, they may have an entirely different thoughts on a subject as do the general public. And in between those two issues is the veterinarian. You know, whose side do we go on with? The side of the public and the animal rights people and so forth, or do we stick with our owners on what their thoughts are on a particular thing? So it's really a tough situation for the association now. And I never had, you know, problems like that. Very rarely did we have an issue like that, where now it just keeps them going all the time on trying to keep up with these issues and where should veterinary medicine stick their nose in and where should we avoid it. But you don't want to get either side mad at you. So.
Well, it is a challenge. It's not unique to Michigan. It's going on in every state in the union. And so the issue of what are animal rights, what is animal welfare, what are the regulatory aspects of basically a moral responsibility that we as people have for animals, whether they're companion or food animal or performance animals. And it is a challenge, and certainly at the national level, we have an attorney on the staff of the American Veterinary Medical Association who is devoting a lot of time, and we have a separate division within the national organization as well. And Dr. Gail Golab spends full time on dealing with these kinds of issues. We have some real expertise in the state of Michigan in Dr. Swanson, who is in the College of Agriculture and also appointed in the College of Veterinary Medicine. And so she's been very helpful in trying to bring reason and rationale to some of the decisions that the animal rights activists are pushing very hard. So this will continue to be a problem and certainly is another example of how the profession has changed over the past 20, 30 years. Pete, as we've talked here, we haven't said much about the economy, and certainly that's uppermost in a lot of people's mind. As an association, I suspect you had some financial challenges from time to time. Do you recall as some of those challenges, and how did you deal with them?
Well, I think it was maybe shortly before I came on as executive director that the finances of the organization were stressed, and they hadn't had a dues increase in a number of years. And so they made a significant increase in the dues, and that caused a big concern by our members, and a number of them dropped out. But the outcome was that the board of directors decided from now on we're going to raise the dues just a little bit every year and nobody will notice the difference. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have that issue occur. Now, the other thing that helped me was I was in charge of writing up the budget for the board to approve. And I had a philosophy that I was going to put in expenses as high as I thought they might go and put in revenue as low as I thought it might go. So I always was presenting the board with a deficit budget, which means if they got any wild ideas on stuff, they were very cautious about it. Until one of the meetings, after a number of years, they had an issue come up like that, and they wanted to do some spending, and somebody said, "No, Pete says here we are at a deficit budget." And one of the board members says, "Never mind that, Pete always has a deficit budget." So my little game was exposed. But we didn't actually, our funds and so forth were in good shape when I left. Mm-hmm. And I have no reason to think that Carlene hasn't kept them there.
Yeah.
But we really just didn't have a problem on that.
So good conservative planning and great support from the board of directors was helpful.
Yes, yeah.
Pete, we've talked about the Board of Veterinary Medicine, and I think we need to take a minute to clarify and define how the licensing board of veterinary medicine is composed and how that differs from the role of the Michigan Veterinary Medical Association. Do you want to make a couple of comments related to that?
Yeah, well, supposedly they're complete opposites. The MVMA is out to help veterinarians, and the Board of Veterinary Medicine is out to help the public. Mm-hmm. And I always had a tried to set up a policy where the people that were on the Board of Veterinary Medicine were not involved in the leadership of MVMA at that particular time, because it didn't look good to the public if they were filing a complaint against a veterinarian with the Board of Veterinary Medicine and they found out the head of the Board of Veterinary Medicine was the veterinarian down the street or something. So the board, which is made up mostly of veterinarians, still had to be very careful on how they made their decisions, because they were trying to protect the public.
So the Board of Veterinary Medicine is really regulatory on behalf of the citizens of the state of Michigan, and the MVMA is basically an association of veterinarians who help one another in terms of quality of practice and various issues that might confront the profession as a whole. Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we get a lot of calls into the MVMA on complaints on veterinarians. And we have to tell those people we have no authority to regulate a veterinarian. If a veterinarian is doing something wrong, we have no legal authority to go in and investigate it and reprimand that veterinarian. Now, what we might do is if a client calls in on a complaint, I would always try to call a veterinarian and let them know this is the complaint. Didn't try to make any judgments as whether it was right or wrong, true or false or not, but I wanted that member to know this happened. And most of the time, if a veterinarian found out that something bad did happen, they were right on trying to take care of it, calling up the client, try to make amends on it and so forth. But if in this day and age where lawsuits are so common that people, it's very hard to get them quieted down. They want investigations now. They want the legal aspects of complaints, where a number of years ago it was a lot easier to resolve these issues without involving the attorneys.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pete, we've covered a lot of ground here this morning, and I want to thank you very much for spending the time with me in talking about the history of the Michigan Veterinary Medical Association. You've certainly contributed very well over the years, both as a member and as the executive director, and it's been my pleasure. We appreciate what you've done for veterinarians and also for the citizens of Michigan. So thanks again, and good luck in your retirement.
Thanks, Jan. Thanks for inviting me to this. It was kind of fun and kind of reminiscing. Now it's been 8 years, but I still stay involved a little bit with the association.
Sure.
They keep me doing a few jobs now and then. Only difference is I don't get paid anymore.
Understand. That's what the retirement's about. Thank you very much.